Good morning. Welcome to our Legacy Committee. I will officially call the meeting to order since a quorum is present. So I'd like to welcome everybody to the committee and look forward to a great presentation from the Arts Board and then from our Commissioner as well for some issues that have arisen just recently. So there's minutes in your packet if folks have seen them or someone would like to adopt them, March 5th minutes. We'll call for motion for those or any corrections.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Heisman. There's a motion to approve. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Okay. We are very fortunate this morning because we have the Department of Revenue, or maybe they're fortunate to be in front of us this morning, to present on legacy fund distribution with calculation errors. The Commissioner Mark Court called me and several others last week with a report of some errors within the last 15 years. And Commissioner, welcome. Thank you for your phone call. And it's always good to see my good friend, whom was one of my favorite members that we worked together for so many years. He is the tax chair, and that was my favorite committee for 6 years. So certainly enjoyed being with you, and good to see you, Commissioner. Sorry that you have to be here under these circumstances. It was not good news, for sure. But you're here to explain why, and I'm sure that we'll have some questions as well, Commissioner. So with that, I will turn the meeting over to Commissioner Paul Marquardt.
Well, thank you very much, Chairman McDonald. Thank you for those kind words, and it's nice to be here. I'm Paul Marquardt. For the record, I am the Commissioner of the Department of Revenue, and I'm joined here at the table by Chief Financial Officer Maggie Rettenhaus and Legislative Coordinator Devin Armstrong. Again, thank you so much for inviting us to be able to talk about this legacy fund over distribution. And the Department of Revenue, we receive and distribute a lot of funds to a lot of accounts during the course of a year. And in this situation, the Department of Revenue over a series of time over distributed to the legacy fund to the tune of about $31.7 million that went to the legacy fund instead of the general fund. And so on behalf of the Department of Revenue, I want to apologize to the Legacy Finance Committee and to the Legacy Fund because I know this is going to increase some challenges as you go to work on a budget. So apologies to the Finance Committee for that. So I'd like to give a few opening comments. I'll turn it over to our Chief Financial Officer to kind of get into the details on kind of what happened and so forth. But the kind of thing to know about about this is that there was one entity that on the receipts that we received, all of those dollars went into a fund that funds programs that benefited Minnesota taxpayers. In this situation, though, a portion of those funds, 5.45% of the funds that came in on the receipt from this entity, went into the legacy fund instead of all of it going into the general fund. And so not all of the 100% of the money that came in went to the general fund. And we know that the general fund funds education and health care and public safety and taxes and all those things. So instead of 100% going in there, 5.45% went to the legacy fund, outdoor heritage and clean water and parks and trails and all of those areas. And so in the end, there wasn't an over collection of revenue or an under collection of revenue. It was just that instead of 100% going to the general fund over time, 5.45% went to the legacy fund. And you're wondering, where does the 5.45% come from? That's the percent of 0.375% of the sales tax, that is the legacy fund, out of the 6.875%. And that's just kind of how it works as you take that 5.45%. So every year, this totaled about $2.1 million, Mr. Chair, which is a little under a half percent of the legacy fund annual receipts. But over 15 years, this started in 2010, basically after the amendment was passed, for 15 years, this totals up to about $31.7 million, which is about 6.4% of the total revenues that come into the legacy fund. So the good news here is it has been corrected. The 31.7 will go into the general fund, million will go into the general fund, and moving forward, this has been corrected so that in the future, we will have an accurate distribution. So at this time, if I might, I'd like to turn this over to our Chief Financial Officer, Ms. Rittenhouse.
Ms. Rittenhouse.
Yes, thank you, Chair. So I'd like to give a little background on our standard processes at Department of Revenue to understand how this occurred. On a monthly basis, the department distributes sales and use tax lines from the general fund into the legacy fund. We take 5.45%, which the commissioner just shared with you, which is the 0.375% of 6.875%, and we multiply that by a multitude of lines that file on the sales and use tax tax filings. There's one specific line called the variable rate line. This is a relatively unique line on the sales and tax return. It's for any taxpayer who pays use tax on purchases from other states, if the other state has a lower use tax. We understood in the financial department that everyone who filed on that line was subject to the legacy rate of the 6.875% in total. You can go to the next slide. During our review in January, we were documenting in detail all of our distributions for legacy. We identified that the Minnesota Lottery was actually filing on the variable rate line. It's actually an in lieu of tax, so it's not technically a sales tax. The department likely advised the lottery to file on this line when the in lieu of tax passed, but when the legacy tax passed, we did not revise and have a discussion between the sales and use tax division and the financial management division to recognize that they were not subject to that legacy tax. The Minnesota Lottery did nothing wrong in this case. This was an issue in the Department of Revenue for not coordinating between the two divisions to recognize there was an issue with where they were filing and then how we were distributing funds. So as a result of that, we've been over-distributing on a monthly basis from the general fund into the legacy fund. We identified we quantified this in February. We worked with MMB closely to understand what the impact was back to 2010 and wanted to be sure it was part of the February forecast so that you had the right numbers to go forward with. If you can go to the next slide, I'd like to give just a quick illustration of this so you can understand what happened. So the historical process is we took the total taxes reported on the variable rate line. In this case, as an example, $1,000. We then multiplied that by the legacy rate, that 5.45%, and that would put $54.50 to the legacy fund. What we're doing now and what we should have been doing historically is we should have actually been removing the lottery. In this case, we're estimating at $100 from that amount and only multiplying the amount that was subject to legacy, so $900 in this case, and putting that into the legacy funds. In this case, this example, $5.45 was over-distributed to the legacy fund. So that goes through how we've addressed this. We're now manually pulling out lottery and working on a long-term solution to be sure that we don't do anything like this, obviously, in the future. This is somewhat of an anomaly because of it's in lieu of tax, and we have reviewed with our legal department any other items in the sales tax chapter that would be like lottery, and we have identified nothing else that's similar. So I'll pass it back to you, Commissioner.
So thank you very much. And so just the last couple slides, this is the financial impact. There is the $31.7 million that we have been talking about that was over-distributed to the legacy fund. And, you know, it's about $2.1 million a year. And then, a total of 31.7, which is about 6.4% of the fiscal 24 legacy fund revenues. And the final slide is just making sure we get this right going into the future. So as our Chief Financial Officer just mentioned, the corrections have been made to assure this doesn't occur into the future. And, you know, the one-time shift has been made also. And, you know, that was reported in the February forecast under the consolidated fund statement. You'll see where it'll talk about prior period adjustments, and that's where that is at. So Again, appreciate your resilience in all this and understand the extra challenges this will create for your committee and for the Legacy Fund. So, Mr. Chair and members will stand for questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. First question is, what did you have to find this on our watch? Couldn't you found the mistake last year or maybe 15 years ago when I was elected? So, well, thank you. Members, questions? Representative DePell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the commissioner coming out and explaining this. And I was wondering, as looking at this from a business perspective, as a business owner, I've got 20 employees and a budget to look over, and this impact is broad and large. It's over $30 million. And my district actually needs a lot of money for a water filtration system, and the need for that is just under $30 million. I'm wondering, has anybody been either disciplined or terminated, or has there been any repercussions for such a big mistake?
So, Commissioner Marquardt.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Deppel, this certainly traces back to 2010 when this started. And I think what's important now moving forward is that we get this right. And we certainly understand the significance of this. As far as employment changes, the main things we're doing is changing our way of operation here, just to make sure that we have a system in place that kind of catches these anomalies as we move forward.
Representative DePell.
Can you explain a little bit further what that system is so we can be assured that it won't happen again?
Commissioner Rittenhouse.
Thank you, Chair.
Chief Financial Officer.
Thank
Rittenhouse.
You, Chair, Representative. Yes, the best way to fix, you know, to address this issue is to catch it before it happens. It's very difficult to find an anomaly like this without preventative measures. So what we have instituted is at the end of every legislative session, we will be reviewing each of the taxing divisions, all of the laws that have passed, which we do already, but talk to them about our existing distributions to ensure that there is nothing that has passed that should change the methodology of existing activities that we do, and that would have prevented this from happening from the get-go. The reason that we found this specifically, we were answering questions about the Legacy Fund with the OLA, and so we discovered lottery by digging into who the taxpayers are, which typically my division doesn't go down into the taxpayer level. We usually are dealing with the kind of the top level, but that is why, so that's when we had the conversation with sales and use tax and put together an internal control so that we don't allow something like this to happen again when something passes and affects activities that we are already doing.
Representative DePell.
Is it possible that this is happening or has happened on other, clearly it's possible, but are you taking measures to go back and make sure this hasn't happened elsewhere?
Ms. Rittenhouse.
Yes, Chair, Representative. Yes, we've reviewed with our legal team as well as the Sales and Use Tax Division all of the sales tax chapter to be sure there is no other entity like lottery that is paying only the general sales tax as opposed to the legacy amount. And we reviewed every tax line to be sure that the ones that we're including in the legacy distribution are accurate.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, thank you for coming and your team as well. Just a couple of clarifications. I think I heard that this was found by the OLA, but maybe I misunderstood that. And then the timeline for that is a little unclear to me, as the announcement seemed to coincide with the budget forecast. So it just seems a little bit strange, and if you could address those things, that'd be helpful.
Ms. Rittenhouse.
Yes, Chair and Representative. We were asked during the annual audit from OLA, we were asked questions about the legacy distributions. We answered all of those questions appropriately. There was no issue found in the audit. When my team started to look behind the scenes to be sure we were documenting things appropriately, they discovered that Minnesota Lottery was reporting this. We discovered this in January. It took us about 5 weeks to go back to 2010 to actually quantify the issue. This was before we had our integrated tax system. It was before we had our accounting system. So we had to go back and get, you know, Excel files, et cetera, to come up with the exact amount. We then shared that with MMB in early February, worked with them to be sure that we could quantify and how we should deal with it in the forecast, and then disclosed right, you know, as the forecast came out. So we worked with speed to try to get this information out and get the right number.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I believe I understand a little bit better now. So it wasn't OLA that found this error, but it was your office that found that there was a problem. So, okay. Thank you for that clarification.
Very good. Representative Vang, or I should say Co-Chair Vang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank the commissioner and your team for identifying this error and finding a quick resolution to this. I know that this was not due to the fault of your team. This was about 10, 15 years ago. I believe it was during Pawlenty years. And so I'm glad that you and your team were able to find the issue and resolve it quickly. Although it's definitely not the best news and what we would like to hear in the committee, but I appreciate you all being transparent and upfront and letting us know the resolution and how you guys have fixed it. So thank you for that.
Representative, or I should say Vice Chair Scraba.
Thank you, Chair. Couple of questions. How often do you review?
Ms. Rittenhouse, or yes,
Ms. Rittenhouse. On an annual basis, we review our distributions, and actually on a monthly basis, we have internal controls such that, you know, one person does the distribution and a second person reviews them. This really was an anomaly in the sense of it was with a specific taxpayer that honestly our controls wouldn't have caught without this addition that we're now going to do on an annual basis to be sure past distribution logic is incorrect based on a new law that passed. So we are reviewing distributions constantly, monthly, and annually. It was a law that passed that we had a miscommunication between the sales and use tax division and our financial management division.
Vice Chair Scraba.
So you found the error, and now we're $31 million. Technically, we collected $31 million that we shouldn't have. Is that
Ms. Rittenhouse?
Chair and Representative, there's no problem with it. We have collected that amount of money. That's true. It just should have stayed in the general fund as opposed to have gone to the legacy fund.
So this fund needs to pay back $31 million to the general fund?
Chair, Representative, that we have actually made that correction. So it's an accounting correction. So we shifted the funds back from the legacy fund into the general fund as of last Friday.
So this year's distribution is going to be $31 million short?
Commissioner Marquardt.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scraba, I think the best way is if you look at the consolidated fund statement that comes out, it's listed as a prior period adjustment. And so, yeah, I mean, and that's a negative line. So it's distributed among each of the four. So how that works exactly, but yes, there will be, it shows a negative number there for each of those funds.
Vice Chair Scraba.
Mr. Chair, so is there any way that we can divide this $31 million instead of taking it from this year's allocation to take 15 this year and 15 next year?
Commissioner.
Chair and Representative Scraba, I mean, that would be something probably for the legislature. That's not something the Department of Revenue can do. I mean, what we're doing is adjusting it back to the general fund at this point, and I suppose that would be others that would determine how that could be meted out, I guess.
Vice Chair Scraba, I'm going to have Mr. Hagemeyer answer an input on that.
Mr. Chair, so it's 31.7 over the four funds, so it's like 10.4 million to clean water, 10.4 to outdoor heritage, smaller amounts for the other two funds. It can go over the 2 years for the ones that we make biennial appropriations for, because we have to have a 5% reserve for each fund for each year. So aside from the Outdoor Heritage Fund, we can spread it across the 2 years of the biennium. Outdoor Heritage kind of has to take it all in the first year because they have a first year appropriation only. But of the $31 million, I think about a third of that was reduced by better sales tax increases in 25 and 26 and investment income. So it's 31, about a third of that was bought back basically by better tax revenues in February compared to November.
Thank you, Mr. Hagemeyer. Right, Vice Chair Scrappa.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. The Outdoor Heritage Fund will take the biggest hit up front.
Mr. Hagemeyer.
Mr. Chair, again, the 31 is evenly distributed across the funds. I think they have the chart they're putting up there. So it's 10.47 million correction to the Outdoor Heritage Fund as well as Clean Water Fund. Clean Water Fund, the committee typically makes a biennial appropriation, so we can spread it over 2 years as long as we're keeping a 5% reserve each year. So it's a little lighter on Clean Water Fund, but Outdoor Heritage Fund only has an annual recommendation, so we still have to adhere to the 5% reserve requirement, or we should adhere to that. That's in statute. So you'd need to make the full correction in fiscal year 25 if you wanted to keep the 5% statutory reserve requirement.
Vice Chair Scrabble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The concern I have is the funds that we're giving out this year to the organizations are going to be cut back. And is there a way to disseminate that in the future, not all right here? And I realize that $10 million is coming from advance, but go ahead.
It's a definitely a legitimate question, Vice Chair Scrappa. So, Mr. Hagemeyer, do you want to answer that?
Mr. Chair, again, so none of the funds are appropriated yet for fiscal 26 and 27, so it's a reduction compared to what you anticipated in November, and what a reduction compared to what the Outdoor Heritage Council made recommendations on and what the Clean Water Council made recommendations on, the governor made recommendations on. None of those have passed or enacted, so we're not reducing them in the sense that we're legislatively making a cut to a previous appropriation, but there's less available to appropriate than you anticipated in November.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I realize that it hasn't been given out, but the organizations that are giving the money or that are getting the money are accustomed to, you know, getting a certain amount, knowing that it could change because of the economy. But this is known. Is there any way we can alleviate it and push it out another funding cycle?
Mr. Hagemeyer.
Mr. Chair, I mean, if you wanted to spread it over a longer period than the biennium, you'd have to not withstand the reserve requirements and statute and then run the risk of putting funds negative on a future forecast.
Vice right. Chair Scrubba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Hagemeyer. Thank you.
Well, with a pending looming $6 billion deficit, is unfortunately that the legacy will be one of those areas that will feel a cut in their budgets as well and their funding amongst probably many agencies as we look forward to the future. Co-Chair Vang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to do a quick follow-up with fiscal staff. If you can tell us what the new forecasted amount after this correction.
Mr. Chair, I can pull it up if you just give me a minute.
Oh, yes, Mr. Hagemeyer. All right, while you pull that up, Chair Vang, you have the floor.
I don't have any jokes to entertain anyone while we wait. I just want to say after considering last night's results, seeing last night's results, I expressed before, I do look forward to continue the work with you, Representative Co-Chair McDonald, I hope that you know, so far you've treated us well, and so I appreciate that and the work that you have led this committee so far, and I look forward to continuing that work.
Well, Vice Co-Chair Vang, since this is our editorial time, thank you. I would never mistreat anyone in my 15 years here. It is expected. And I never even mentioned at this committee. I've heard at other committees that, well, I'm certainly glad everybody's respecting everybody. No, it's to be expected here, and I will always respect members, the audience, and all the folks that are part of this. Chair Hagemeyer. I just gave me
a
promotion. Mr. Hagemeyer.
Like a better chair.
Why not?
Mr. Chair, the real chair. Chairs. I do have a new document. I shared it with the CAs for the committee, and I have it posted on the fiscal webpage, but we can make sure it's distributed to all the members as well. Right. Based on the February forecast, the Outdoor Heritage Fund would have $161.991 million available. That's $6.4 million less than anticipated on the November forecast. So you can see already that $10.4 million reduction that was made is in effect $6.4 million because there's better sales tax revenue for the other years. Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund for the biennium would have $179.9 million, which is $4.8 million less than the November forecast. The Clean Water Fund will have $303.9 million over the biennium, and that's $6.8 million less than anticipated in November. And then the Parks and Trails Fund would have $130.1 million, and that's $3 million less than the November forecast. But again, I have a full document that we share with the CAs, and I can make sure it gets sent to members as well.
Chair Vang.
That'll be all. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Well, we're going to wrap this up. We appreciate the Commissioner and the CFO and Ms. Armstrong being here and presenting to us To Air is Human. I think that you probably covered well the work that you've done. I do just one question. Was there a certain trigger that you found that you were able to uncover this? Or was it a couple of months of investigation or a couple of weeks? Or?
Chair, when we were asked the question about the legacy funds with the OLA, just to document, that was where my team started doing, just putting in new procedures and documentation, and that was what led us to ask some questions about who was filing where, and that's when we discovered that Minnesota Lottery was there. So, and that happened in January, and that's when we went back to quantify the amount of money.
Very good. Thank you. Well, good work that you uncovered it. I think to our groups here that received the funds, I don't know if it's plausible, but maybe acceptable, Commissioner, that a personal appreciation or maybe an apology to them as well. They're the really ones that will, where the rubber hits the road, will affect them deeply. We just have to decide, of course, you know, the distribution and where we put it. So, but if that's something that you would want to do as well, just let the groups know, and I'm sure they all understand at this point as well. Commissioner, you'll have the last words.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members, for allowing us to talk about the situation. Like, again, it's going to put you in a more difficult position, and we know it's very difficult for all the committees right now in this time, and it's just going to add a little extra challenge to you. And you know, the bottom line is, you know, the funding we received from the lottery and the receipts we took in all went to benefit Minnesotans. It just was a little different mix of which fund it went into, the general fund or the legacy fund. But again, thank you so much for allowing us to talk about what happened here on this.
Thank you, Commissioner. We appreciate you attending and helping us understand this. So with that, you all three are excused and enjoy the rest of your day. Our next testifier is going to be
thank you.
Our Executive Director of the Minnesota Arts Board. She's going to do an overview. So, Ms. Sue Jens, welcome to the table. So you probably know the spiel for the record. You can identify yourself, and you may begin your presentation. But as you're hooking up the presentation in your computer, if there's any questions from members, otherwise we'll just give a pause while she hooks that up. Any students that are in the room today, raise your hands. I noticed some young folks over there. What is your, are you Pages or what's your affiliation? Anyone, spokes, who's a good spokesman or woman? Stand up. There you go. Wait, you look too old to be. What is it? Street Law Force. Well, welcome Mankato East School for coming to the committee meeting. Good to have you here. Always good to have the students here to teach us a thing or two, because we have plenty to learn, indeed. Ms. Jens, are you ready?
I believe so, Mr. Chair.
Well, welcome to the committee, and you may recognize yourself for the record and present your presentation.
Great. Thank you so much. My name is Sue Jens. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Arts Board. I really appreciate the chance to be with you today. Some of you know our agency well. For some of you, this might be an early introduction. And so I'm going to be giving you a high-level overview of the work that we do and how we do that. I do want to say that we have been a long-time recipient of Arts and Cultural Heritage funds. We've been grateful for those funds and have tried to be strong stewards as well. And I apologize, I have a little bit of a raspy voice because I'm at the end of a cold, but I'm going to soldier through. So I think it's important to say that the foundation, the bedrock of everything we do, is the fact that Minnesotans care deeply about the arts. We know that Minnesotans participate in the arts at higher levels than in other states. We know that Minnesotans care about the health and well-being aspects of the arts that they generate. We know that communities are stronger. We know that our economy is bolstered by the contributions that we make in the arts sector. And we know that Minnesotans care deeply about their quality of life, and we are a contributor to that. So because Minnesotans care so deeply about the arts, we have had a very long history of providing public funding for the arts. And in fact, it goes back more than 100 years, 120 years, that the state has had an agency within state government to support and build up the arts sector, and we are that agency. We're in the executive branch. Structure, our responsibilities, and everything is spelled out in state statutes. And you have on your screen and in your handouts our mission statement, which is very broad, and that's intentional, because in the arts, one size does not fit all. What one person might really think is a valuable kind of experience, others may not find so valuable. And so we try to spread out the dollars and fund an array of activities all through the state so that all Minnesotans can find something that is meaningful to them. I mentioned that statute tells us what we can and cannot do, the duties and activities that we must provide, and the first and foremost, over and over again in statute, is that we provide public financial support for the arts. We are a grant maker, it is our primary activity, and we have been doing that for a very long time. We also are the fiscal agent for the regional arts councils, and I will talk a little bit more about that a little bit later on. Those are legislatively mandated grants that we pass through to 11 councils. In statute, we have a number of official relationships and appointments and duties related to other state agencies. I've listed some of those on the screen. And we also manage the state's public art program. You are a finance committee, so I wanted to give you a sense of the dollars that are passing through our agency. On this screen, you have our fiscal 24-25 revenue. On the very top, there is a very small gray slice. That is the funding that we receive from the federal government. We receive an annual grant from the National Endowment for the Arts. The orange slice or yellow slice is our general fund appropriation. That's about $7.8 million per year. And then the very large green slice that you see is the funding from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. And you were talking a minute ago about how that funding goes up and down because the state's economy was very strong and there was more money in the 24-25 session. Our appropriation went up pretty substantially. So you'll see that's 85% of our funds, $97.9 million for the biennium. We're going to follow that green slice onto the next slide. And this shows you how the appropriations laws for 24 and 25 divide up those legacy dollars. So again, a large green slice, about 60% of the funds are available for us to use in our competitive grant programs. I'll talk about that in just a second. The red slice was a legislatively mandated grant for a public art project here in St. Paul. Some of you may have seen the beautiful Loon statue that's along University and Snelling. The blue slice is the legislatively mandated grants to the regional arts councils. That's about 30% of the funds. And then the yellow slice at the top, 5% is what you have been allowing us to use for grants administration, administrative costs, managing the regional arts council system, and other outreach and technical assistance. I'm going to talk about those competitive grants, that larger green slice that you saw a second ago on the slide. And I'll talk a little bit about how we decide how to use those dollars, how we spend those dollars. First and foremost is the application process. How do people know that they can come to us for funding? In January of every calendar year, we post on our calendar the programs that we're going to be offering for the coming fiscal year. So January of 25, we posted 6 grant programs that we're going to be offering in fiscal 26, again, assuming that we receive funding from the legislature. And those 6 programs are listed on the slide. We have an operating support program, basic support, core support for about 200 of Minnesota's most important arts organizations. We make grants to individual artists. And then we have 4 project grant programs that really align with what the legacy amendment is meant to do: an accessible arts program, arts education, arts experiences, and then cultural expression. We post materials, we post the deadline dates, we post the date when we're going to award those grants, and we post the period when somebody can use those funds, so that anybody who wants to has enough advance notice that they can ask us questions, and they have time to submit and prepare an application. We use a great deal of online information. You know, everybody's doing things on their phones now, so we do webinars that are very high level. If you don't know where to start with the Arts Board, we have a high level overview if you're an individual or an organization. You have a way in. And then we also do online webinars for each of the individual programs with more details about how to apply. We also do a great deal of one-on-one work. We have program staff that answer questions, have meetings, do emails, and they will even read draft applications if those come in early enough for them to have a chance to do that. So we try to help applicants prepare their best proposals that they can. We're not like a private funder where the staff goes into the board and advocates for one program or another, but they're simply helping every applicant do the best they can to apply. Here are the steps in the review process and also our criteria, and I'll talk a little bit more about each of those. I won't read the slide. I know you have a chance to do that. The first thing that happens whenever a grant application comes in, our staff reviews it to make sure that it's an eligible application, it meets all of the requirements that are posted in our guidelines, and that it's complete, that it's not blank, and that they've provided the financial information and other things that they need. You'll see on this slide on the left-hand side the word advisor in several places. We think that is our great strength. I don't decide how we're going to spend our funds. My staff doesn't decide that. We recruit more than 450 individuals from across the state of Minnesota who have experience in the arts and experience in nonprofit management. They read the applications. They score the applications. They discuss the applications in an open public meeting that is televised. They're virtual meetings now because of COVID. And then after they've had a chance to review them, to discuss them, they submit final scores. And our staff takes those scores and comes up with a ranked list of proposals to recommend. Because there are about 450 of them, we divide them into teams. And each team reads 25 to 30 applications in a specific grant program. They don't read them across all of the programs. Those 450 people last year contributed more than 9,000 hours to our process, reading the applications, discussing them in a meeting, assigning the scores. So we think that that citizen involvement is really helpful so that Minnesotans are deciding how their tax dollars will be invested in the arts. The items that have an asterisk by them are extra steps that we take in the program, the operating support program, where we can award grants that are greater than $50,000. So we do a financial risk assessment. We look at their financial statements before those proposals move forward. We have what we call an administrative visit with those applicants, where the program officer and one of those advisors can ask more questions about the proposal. And we have advisors going around the state doing artistic visits. They go to a performance, they go to an exhibition, they write up a report about what the experience was. What did they see? Was it an ADA accessible facility? Did people seem engaged in the work? On the right-hand side are the criteria that we use in that larger program where we can award larger grants. And we're really looking at the overall organization, the health of the organization, its financial management, the stability of its board. We're looking at how they're engaging people in their work. We're also looking at the public benefits they provide, and that might be things like they're working as a tourism destination in their community, or it might be that they're working with their local chamber of commerce on business retention or business recruitment, or maybe they're working with a senior facility or a youth program on health and well-being, mental health, physical health. We also look at the degree to which they're using evaluation to understand if their programs are effective. The below the line, those three criteria are the ones we use in our five project grants. First of all, we want to know that the applicant, whether it's an individual or organization, is committed to engaging Minnesotans in the arts. If I like to paint in my attic on the weekends, that's fine. If I'm not planning to do that and share that with anybody else, then I don't need a state grant to help me do that. But if I'm a painter and I want to do exhibitions and I want to show my work, or maybe I want to teach classes at my local community arts center, then maybe a state grant is appropriate. So we look at their commitment to engaging Minnesotans in their work. We also look at the feasibility of the plan that they've provided. Does the budget seem reasonable? Does the timeline seem reasonable? Does it seem like they can do the work the way that they have proposed? Do they have some sort of a track record? And then finally, we ask all of our project grantees to talk about the degree to which they might be serving underserved populations. And underserved can mean a lot of different things in a lot of different parts in the state. And so the applicant defines that. They tell us who they think in their area is not having the access to the arts that they might like. And we ask this question because we know in Minnesota that some people have a great deal of access to the arts and others don't. And with the legacy funds that are dedicated for arts, arts access, arts education, and preserving Minnesota's cultural heritage, that we want to provide greater access and get those benefits of the arts out to more people. Once our board has approved that list of recommendations that comes to us from those 450 advisors, we enter it into a contract. Our program officers, we have four program officers, they keep in touch. They ask questions, send out emails, how are you doing, are you running into any problems, can we help you in some way? We also get a lot of requests for contract amendments. Our timelines are long, and so somebody might say, I need a different venue, I need to change some artists, I need to move some money around. And so our program staff works with all of those grantees to make contracts amendments. And they're written amendments to the contract. It's not something that somebody just goes out and makes changes. For the larger grants, greater than $50,000, we do a monitoring visit during the grant period, and we also do financial reconciliation. That's consistent with the Office of Grants Management's policies. And we get a final report and a final accounting for how funds were spent at the end of every project, no matter how large the grant was, whether it was $5,000 or something significantly larger than that. On the right side is just a snapshot of our numbers. We make a lot of grants. We review a lot of applications, about 1,600 to 1,700 applications a year. We make close to 1,000 grants a year all throughout the state of Minnesota. And you can see based on the dollars requested and the dollars awarded that the requests far exceed what we are able to provide. So we can always use and invest more dollars if we had them. We understand that we have to make choices just like you have to make choices. If I have a little time, and I think I do, I wanted to tell you a couple of stories about the pictures on the left side of the screen. Numbers are one thing, but you know what's happening with those dollars. So at the top of the slide is a summer theater camp that was funded with an arts education grant. The grantee is an organization called New Native Theater. And it's a free summer camp for grade school and high school students. They get a chance to learn about theater, you know, how do you act, how do you direct, how do you, you know, block a show. And they also learn about puppetry, they learn about storytelling, they learn about mask making. And as the name New Native Theater might imply, they then use some sort of Native traditional story and they make a play that they present to their instructors, to their family, to the community at the end of this free summer camp. And for some kids, it's the first chance to be on stage, the first chance to try out acting. Some people love acting, some people hate it. But it's a good way to try it. And it's a program that we funded now, I think, two summers. The middle photo, a little hard to see, it's black and white. This is an organization called Chamber Music Live. It's based in Houston, Minnesota, if you know where that is, way down in the southeast corner of the state. Houston has a population of 983 people. And this organization received an arts experiences grant from us, which is about, again, providing experiences that might not otherwise be available. And they hosted a two-week chamber music concert series. Again, free activities, indoor concerts, outdoor concerts. They also did some programming in the library for kids, some chamber music concerts for kids. And the reason they wanted to do this is because there's a pretty strong older population in that part of the state that loves classical music, loves chamber music, and doesn't have as many opportunities to hear live classical music as they might like. Maybe they don't drive to the Twin Cities. Maybe they don't drive to Rochester. Maybe transportation is an issue. And their participants said that it was really a wonderful, they said, exceptional experience in our rural backyard to have this kind of quality in this kind of program. And then the bottom photo is Festival de la Calaveras, based on the holiday of the Day of the Dead. And it was, fall festival that had music, it had dancing, it had family art-making activities, it had spoken word, it had visual arts. And it was a way to celebrate our Latina artists in Minnesota. We have tremendous Latina artists in the state. It was also a chance for somebody like me, who is not of the Latina culture, to go to this free event, learn about those traditions, see these wonderful figures, and participate in some of those activities and learn a little bit about their rich culture. Again, a free activity. I picked these out of the thousands of examples I could have given you because none of these organizations and none of these activities existed before there was a legacy amendment. This is an example of some of the new things that are happening now because there is more funding available.
Ms. Jen, before you move to the next slide, just for practicality, do you know the kind of the funding that each of these in that slide you presented before got? The theater, the music, and the Latino dance culture?
I do mostly, Mr. Chair. I know that two of them were $35,000 grants, and one of them was $34,900. So it's not uncommon in our project grant programs, which top out at $35,000, for an applicant to ask for the most that they are allowed to request.
Thank you, Ms. Jensen. The follow-up on that. Now, they are able to apply for another, year after year after year, correct?
They are indeed, Mr. Chair.
Very good. You may continue.
Thank you. I wanted to talk a little bit about the Regional Arts Council system. I had mentioned that those are legislatively mandated grants that we pass through, both general fund and legacy fund dollars, pass through to 11 regional arts councils. This is a community mural in Brainerd that was sponsored by one of the regional arts councils. So there are 11. And in 1976, the Minnesota legislature directed the Arts Board to establish this network of regional arts councils. It didn't put structure around it. It didn't tell us who the council should be or how to do that, but just said, do this so that we can make sure that state funding, at the time only general fund dollars, are reaching every county in every part of the state. We are the envy of other states for a variety of reasons, and this is one of them, because in many other states, it's harder for funding to get outside of their larger metropolitan areas into rural areas, and that has not been the case in Minnesota for more than 50 years. There are 11 because originally the money was given to regional development commissions, and they ran arts programs, and then eventually all of those regions separated from their regional development commission and became nonprofits. You'll see the boundaries here and the counties that are in each of those regions. Regional Arts Council system in statute is there to stimulate or to generate local and regional arts development so that we don't just have strong arts communities in Minneapolis and St. Paul and in St. Cloud and in Rochester and other places, but we are building a strong arts community all across the state of Minnesota. I mentioned that all 11 of those organizations are now nonprofits. They have their own local boards. They have local authority for decision making. They don't have to send their ranked list of grants back to us or ask us for permission. But what they do is they put together a two-year biennial plan. They're working on them right now. They'll submit those to us on the 1st of April. We put together a committee that reviews those plans, and then we make comments. We ask them questions like you ask of us here at the Arts Board, and then we approve those plans, and then they have their basically their blueprint for the next 2 years. What programs will they offer? What services will they offer? And they tell us specifically how they would project that they're going to spend those funds for the next 2 years. Throughout the grant period that they are involved in, we have a great deal of conversation and contact with them. We don't just sign a contract and they go away. I meet with the Regional Arts Council directors every month. We talk often. We have a standing Regional Arts Council director, a standing Regional Arts Council report on our monthly board meetings. So we work very closely together, and we really consider ourselves partners, not just a grantor-grantee relationship. I'd mentioned that Regional Arts Councils each are responsible for coming up with their own programs and their own services tailored to their own part of the state. So what's needed in the far southeast corner of the state may not be appropriate for the far northwest corner of the state. They do different kinds of things. But we put on the screen some of the kinds of grant programs that they're offering. It's no surprise all of the regional arts councils are funding individual artists. That's the bedrock of any strong arts community. They're funding arts organizations, oftentimes volunteer organizations that are just getting started. I love the rural and small arts town grants in parts of the state that are very, very rural. They want to make sure that money gets into all the corners of their regions. And you'll see the stats for the regional arts councils in the last few years. They're making about 150 grants per region. Now, that varies. Some do a lot more than that. Some do less than that. But that gives you a sense of their volume. And the last thing that they do, again, because it's about developing the arts, about helping emerging artists, helping emerging arts organizations, they do professional development workshops. Some of them do grants for professional development. Many of them have galleries, and they will do art exhibits because there are fewer spaces to show work in some communities, newsletters, calendars, other kinds of services that they think are important in their region. So I'm going to wrap up, Mr. Chair, with one last slide with information. I've given you all quite a bit of information, a lot of numbers, but these are really the most important numbers, we think. I'm one person here, but next to me are the 500-plus people who are deciding how to spend the taxpayer dollars that those applications we receive and the Regional Arts Councils receive. Beyond that are the thousands of grantees who are receiving that money, both individuals and organizations, large and small. And in the last biennium, those programs reached just under 25 million people. So we are small but mighty. We try to use our dollars as efficiently as possible. We see that Main Streets light up when there are arts activities. And so the work that we do is really, again, to reinforce this idea that every Minnesotan, no matter where they live, no matter who they are, should have access to arts experiences that are meaningful to them. And that's the work that we will continue to do should you see fit to appropriate funds to us for the coming biennium. So I will stop there, Mr. Chair, and I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you, Ms. Jens, for your presentation. We have a couple minutes for some questions. Representative Vice Chair Scraba.
Really quick. Thank you, Chair. The picture, last picture, State Theater, Ely, Minnesota. This weekend is the film festival.
Good plug, good Vice caught. Chair Scraba. Well done. Well played. Who we got? Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Jens, thank you for coming, and thank you for the work you've been doing through the years. In the last couple of years, we encouraged free days and, opening up. Some of these performances are a little pricey for, many folks. You'd be surprised how hard it is to financially, even if you have some money, it's still hard to to get a family in financially. How are you doing in that space? That effort.
Ms. Jens.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lilly, thank you for that question. I expected that question, and I thought I had some data here. So many of the project grants, most of the project grants that we award are for free activities, and I mentioned a couple of them today. We have not yet cataloged all of those for this biennium, and we will. But I wanted to give you some data from the operating support program, the one program that we have had for a very long time. We do ask them to report on activities that they are doing for free, and those 200 organizations last year did more than 6,000 free activities, and there were free activities in every single legislative district in the state. So whether that's a school residency or a school performance, it might be a performance in a library or readings in a library. It was classes and workshops for seniors, performances in senior facilities. We're seeing more and more of that sort of work happening. Artist talks and lectures, open rehearsals, open studios, open studio tours, outdoor concerts, arts festivals, arts exhibitions, and online programming that is free as well. Since COVID, there's more content available online. So we know that there are substantial numbers of free activities that are being provided by the organizations, and we are going to do a better job as we collect final reports to make sure that we can capture that more. But the message is clear, and many organizations are really trying to offer free programming, especially as they're working to serve underserved communities for whom economics might be a barrier.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, and Ms. Gent, so now that I kind of transition out of leadership on this committee, I can kind of selfishly look at my district a little bit. And one of the flaws I've noticed through the years is my district doesn't get served that well with these grants. I know you, in your documents, you have 5,300, almost 54, without my readers, I can't see, 5,300 grants that go out. And I noticed you sent out a printout, and I hope all members look at it, what grants go in your districts. And I think last year I didn't get any special treatment. I think we had like three or four that went in my district. So I did, there's 67 districts in the state, so each of us should be getting about 79, 80 projects in our grants going to our districts, and I think I had three. So it's just a little frustrating. And I wonder if you're making an effort to spread these grants around to the 67 districts that are, you know, a little better job on that.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Jens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative Lilly. We have done some outreach this past year. It has not been specifically related to legislative districts, but it's been based on counties. We did an analysis maybe a year ago of Arts Board and Regional Arts Council funds on a per capita basis into all 87 counties. And then we started doing some what we call our Grants 101 workshops for people who might not have thought about the state as an arts funder. Some people know about that, some people don't. And we'll continue to do that work. We hired an outreach coordinator this past year, and we'll continue to look at places where we are not getting as many applications. Mm-hmm. In some cases, it's because there maybe aren't as many potential applicants, artists living there or organizations living there. But we will do our best, and working with the regional arts councils, to try to identify places that are just not getting as many grants as some of the others.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Gents. It just seemed drastic. You know, I have a very diverse community, and I know that there's a lot of art that's happening. It's just I don't feel like the grants are getting there in that way, and I think they might help countywide, yes, but there's a lot more to the counties than downtowns necessarily. On a positive note, I think, you know, we're getting towards the end of the legacy and renewing, which, you know, we had the successful renewal of LCCMR, and I think there are a lot of grants and good things going on in the arts community, and sometimes, you know, the public doesn't necessarily know, but I've noticed, like, public TV really does a good job of showcasing a lot of the arts that, you know, whether it's theater, dance, traditional art or music. I don't know what I've covered. So the public TV does a great job. So is that a conscious effort? Because like last night, you know, there was this beautiful piece where they had a lady. She was up the bluffs at Duluth overlooking the lake and playing, you know, a violin. And it was just amazing, you know. But it kind of stops you. But I think more than likely, the orchestra that she plays for and the job that she had was legacy funded. But are you working then collaboratively with public TV and maybe other media to tell your story or get it out? Because I think there is a lot of these grants that are going a lot of good work, but we have to really keep telling the good story.
Before you answer that, Ms. Jens, I just want to let the team know that we want to wrap up in this section around 11:15, and we have five more questions from members. So, but we want to, in respect to the other parties that are going to testify afterwards. So, if yourself, Ms. Jens, and members can limit the questions, not your questions, but your responses afterwards, just a little notice. Ms. Jens.
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Lilly. We had a strong relationship with public television early on when they were doing Minnesota Original. You might remember that, where most of those stories that they featured were our grantees. So we have less of a direct connection with public television at the moment. But many of the things that you see happening are indeed funded by the Arts Board. So one of the things we're in the process of doing is adding a communications person to our staff who can do a better job of collecting those stories and sharing them either via social media or doing a better job of making sure that people understand that they're Arts Board funded. I think a lot of people see the Clean Water, Land, and Legacy Amendment logo. And they don't necessarily know if it's Arts Board funded or the Historical Society funded or the Humanities Center funded, and maybe that matters, maybe it doesn't. But we do want to make sure that Minnesotans have a better sense of how we are providing those funds in Minnesota.
Very good. Soon to be co-chair Vang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Executive Director, I'm just curious to see how competitive the selection process is. What would be a typical factor for like an applicant to not make it through the final round?
Ms. Jens.
Mr. Chair, soon to be co-chair Vang. Where applications, I think, have lower scores is when they've not been very clear or complete about what they're planning to use the funds for. They haven't really had a well thought out plan. Or it's an organization or an individual that maybe really isn't yet focused on how they want their work to affect others or how they want to share that work with others. So it's more about, you know, what will I get out of this? What will the grant do for me? And that's important, especially in our grants for individual artists, because we do want to invest in their growth. But we have always believed that public funding has to benefit the public. And so making a strong case about how you're going to serve whatever community is that you want to try to serve, that really helps set one application apart from others.
Representative Hussein.
Executive Director, good to see you. And thanks for the wonderful presentations and I do see that there's a number of participants underage are participating this kind of grant. Do you see it's this number of increasing applicant for those grants that apply in? And do you, how many times a year do you publish for those grants? Like every twice a year or is it? And how you reach out to underserved community for them to participate and apply for this kind of wonderful arts cultural.
Ms. Jens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hussein. I'll answer the first question first. We do see more and more grant proposals coming in wanting to serve young people. I think we all understand that the kinds of arts experiences that kids are getting in schools these days might be diminishing, and so community-based arts activities, we do see that number increasing. Your question about how do we get the word out, we publish the calendar early in the year, so we do that in January. And then we use our email system. We've got about 30,000 contacts on our email system. And the regional arts councils have been very good about spreading the word as well. And so we do try to connect with connector organizations that might know people that we don't yet know. And so if there are connector organizations that you would want to suggest, we'd be happy to reach out to them. The other thing we did, and I know we're short on time, so I don't want to go too deeply into this, but we hired 5 people this year on contract to do public engagement work for us in the 4 primary racial ethnic communities, but also in the disability community. And they've brought back now suggestions to us about connector organizations and other ways to get the word out. So we're going to continue to expand on that work.
Thank you, Ms. Jens. Representative Momani Hiltzi.
Thank you so much, Chair. Mine, hopefully it's going to be quick. You talked about the 400 reviewers across the whole entire state, right? I'm curious to know, how do we come up with that number, or how are you recruiting those reviewers? From the spirit of diversity, because this space is very diverse and the work that is being done is very diverse, and we definitely want to make sure that the reviewers that are sitting and reviewing these applications are diverse in nature as well. Thank you.
Ms. Jens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much for that question. We have a full-time recruiter on our staff who uses all of the traditional methods that we have, social media and our email system, the regional arts councils as well. We're doing more and more events, so we have gone to community events where we have a table and we try to talk to folks and encourage them to become reviewers. We've done more of those kinds of things around the state. And my response to Representative Hussein's question about connecting with connector organizations who also have access in their networks, we are working to continue to expand the percentages. We do track what percentage of our reviewers are from Greater Minnesota, what percentage of our reviewers identify as a BIPOC individual, and what percentage of our reviewers are a person with a disability, so that we can reach those goals of representing and reflecting the state population.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much. So on my side of the aisle, this is the one thing that I'm super excited about, I guess, the only one on this side who loves the arts and cultural heritage stuff. last one I was at was a Elton John and Billy Joel tribute, which was just spectacular, and there's no way that my small community would have been able to bring that quality of a performer to the area. So very, very appreciative of that. And with that, one of the big things that I'm always disappointed in is when I hear other individuals kind of downing this money, and they always point to one or two of the 5,309 grants that were given out. Can you explain to us a little bit more about how the great amount of vetting that goes through these grant processes to ensure that when you walk in, you have a wonderful experience of the arts, and no one's walking into something that they could be, you know, find offensive or morally unethical or those kind of things. Thank you.
Ms. Jens, briefly, please.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that question, Representative Olson, and thank you for your strong support of the Fairmont Opera House. It's a jewel in the state, and we're glad to support that and the Red Rock Center. In the arts, no one is forced to go to any activity that we fund. So it's always voluntary. You can choose to go or not go. We know that not everything we fund is going to suit someone's tastes or their interests. But we do look for activities and programming that is going to represent the audience that artist or that organization intends to serve. So they have to know their community. They have to know whether that's a geographic community or if it's a community of interest. They have to know who they're going to serve and what might be relevant and meaningful for those individuals. And so what I might like might not be something that you would like, or what another member might like. But we do try to have a broad menu of things that are being funded that are well suited to the community that they're going to serve. And the last thing I'll say, I know you're short on time. Before the legacy amendment, what was common in the arts was to talk about artistic excellence and to review applications based on artistic excellence. We stopped doing that in 2010, and we talked about the quality of the arts experience. What is the arts experience? Knowing that one person with a light bulb and a chair can give you a really moving. So it's not always about a lot of big production values. That's important too. But what is the experience, and is it well suited to the audience that that artist wants to serve, so that there is a better chance that there's going to be a strong, powerful, meaningful event that happens that that person would really enjoy?
Well, as a photographer for the last 36 years, some consider that an art, so I too am a fan of the arts and culture. Oh, yeah, that's right. All right, a last question for you, Ms. Jens, is from a fellow photographer as well, I found out a couple years ago, Representative Cha.
Yes, high school photographer. They dragged me in. Been a photographer since. Thank you, Chair. This question, I'm going to go back to Representative Lilly's question, right? We granted 5,309 number of grants, and we have 67 districts in the state of Minnesota. That means that each district should have got 79 projects. So I guess my question or my request is that can we get a breakout of by district and not counties of what each district got in terms of these grants?
Ms. Jens, real briefly again, but if you could follow up with Representative Cha and all of us. Matter of fact, I did receive a list of the grants that are in my district, and maybe I would assume everybody else received one as well. And if not, could you get one to each member?
We can do that, Mr. Chair. And just quickly, we can give you a list of where the grants were awarded. It doesn't necessarily mean where the actual event took place. That would be an additional set of information. But we certainly can tell you where those grants have been awarded, where the artists and the organizations are based, and we'll do that.
Very good, Ms. Representative Shaw. Excellent. That's the A-OK. Ms. Jens, thank you for your presentation. I had some questions, too, but I'll follow up with you offline sometime. So next we have the presentation from the Minnesota Humanities Center. It's an overview, and we have our CEO, Mr. Kevin Lindsay, is going to present, as well as the grants manager, Ms. Tristy A. Auger. So as they prepare to come to the testifying table, and do you need to hook up your computers as well?
It's this one.
Ms. Auger, do you have to hook up your computer?
Yeah.
No, okay. So members, we have till, quarter to or 10 to. We have a session at noon. Next week's committee meeting will be probably a little different. Representative Chair Vang and I and our leads will be meeting to discuss next week's meeting. I personally am hoping that we can start seeing members' bills. I know there's several members that have bills that pertain to legacy, and I think we need to get to seeing those as well as the presentations. So when you folks are ready, please, for the record, introduce yourselves, and you may begin your presentation. And we're going to go until about 11:45. Hopefully that gives you enough time, Mr. Lindsay.
Yes, Mr. Chair, appreciate the opportunity to testify before you today. Joining me at the table is Tristy Auger. Her last name is spelled A-U-G-E-R, and she is our grants manager. And I serve in the position of the CEO of the Minnesota Humanities Center. We thought we would start out and give you an overview of the grants administration process, and then I would talk about our specific funding request for programming. So I will turn it over to Tristy.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and representatives. We're here today to provide you with an overview and update as it relates to the grants administration that has occurred during the 23-25 biennium. Before I get started, I'd like to take a moment to just acknowledge Minnesota Humanities Center small but mighty grants team. There's three of us, myself included, and we're very proud of the work that we do, and I could not be here with you today without the dedication and support to MHC, our mission, and to our team from my staff. So as background, the National Endowment for Humanities was initiated to help fund state-based humanities programs, and MHC was founded in 1971. MHC's vision is a just society that is curious, connected, and compassionate, curious to come to conversations with open hearts and open minds, and compassionate to authentically hear and listen to one another, connected in that what impacts one impacts all, and compassionate to move beyond connection with fellow citizens and help create a just society, We really seek to create a space for everyone in the state of Minnesota to have their story told and be able to have the space to have their story told. This biennium period, $15.4 million in grants will be administered by MHC. Going back to the history of the organization, this is the highest dollar amount administered by MHC. And for comparison, during the 21-23 biennium, MHC administered approximately $5 million. So our grant program has really grown. There have been several things we've done during this biennium to help ensure success, and I will highlight some of those for you today. For us, there are 9 large buckets as it relates to grant lines. I'd like to point out that direct appropriations is not a grant line. This is really the legislature identifying a specific organization for funding. However, for purposes of today's presentation, I'll reference it as a grant line. Our cultural heritage grants was the largest bucket with almost $9 million during the biennium. Our emergency response grants, this was the first time MHC provided the emergency response grant opportunity. This grant line helped to support 5 organizations lean into a moment of hatred, intolerance, or violence and seek to be a calming space and provide community to create, provide opportunity to create community healing. Our capacity building grants, this was also a new grant line for MHC this biennium. This was something we heard as a need for a long time, specifically for cultural organizations. This grant line allowed a one-time opportunity to help organizations with their growth, development, and capacity. Children's Museums grants is an area where we have historically administered and managed grants at MHC. There is also a direct appropriation grant to the Children's Museum of Minnesota and St. Paul. However, this grant line was a competitive grant program for $2.2 million for other children's museums within the state. Our civics grants provided education for youth on law, democracy, government, and or debate and supported civics education programs. And our festival grant line, this was also the first time MHC provided the festival grant line opportunity. This grant line just concluded and helped to support 16 different cultural events and festivals in Minnesota. We did just launch our cultural and ethnic studies grant line on February 20th. Our grant application deadline is April 7th, so we hope to have some more information for you on that soon. And we hope to announce the Arts and Music Scholarship grant line also soon. To have a successful process and program, we took measures to be proactive and provide good information to folks on the front end. We also considered what the legislature said, which was to streamline the application process. We believe that streamlining the application process was really successful for us during this biennium. We also leveraged our MHC networks, including our connections through NEH, specifically to colleges around the state for the Cultural and Ethnic Studies grant line. Our outreach. Outreach for other grant lines involved reaching out to radio stations and going on TV as well, specifically for our cultural heritage grants. We also had a targeted strategy in various BIPOC newsletters and outlets, too, to make sure that we were getting the word out within communities. We believe that having a variety of advertisement for all of our grant lines really contributed to our application success. For the festival grant line, we did outreach to various festival planners. We also reached out to Minnesota businesses and sent information out to various mayors and deputy mayors throughout the state of Minnesota. As an example of the demand, the festival grant line resulted in $2.4 million requested out of the $450,000 available in funding. We reached that level of requests in less than 60 days. MHC grants team also provided application support and assistance in multiple different ways to applicants. Folks had an opportunity to submit questions online, and they had a chance to contact staff by phone to have their questions answered throughout the application period. We also had 150 interested applicants who took us up on our offer to have 30-minute informational sessions, or informational meetings, excuse me, with a member of our grants team to ask questions regarding their project and assess eligibility. We also hosted 10 general informational sessions that provided specific information tailored to the grant line and legacy requirements. In total, nearly 500 individuals or organizations attended these respective meetings. Many times we're asked about our review process at MHC. MHC has a very thorough three-step review process. I will talk through that process with you here. The first step in the review process is that once an application is submitted, the grants team completes an initial screening to ensure that the application is complete. All the required attachments were provided and that the project fits within the statutory and legacy requirements. If an application passes the initial screening, it is moved over to the review panel or step two. Review panelists are provided with the specific statutory language, so they are aware of the legislative intent. They are also provided the dollar amount available under the grant opportunity, training on how to use our database system, and a metrics guide. A panelist would then score the application, score and rank the application against the other applications received. This information is ultimately forwarded back to MHC's grants team. In our final step of the review process, we would complete a review of the financial documentation requested of the applicant. Following that review process, I would make then my funding recommendation to our CEO, Kevin Lindsay, who ultimately makes our final funding determinations. This slide shares how MHC determined review panels for each grant opportunity. For purposes of staying on time for today's presentation, I'm going to just move to the next slide. This slide provides a snapshot about the amount allocated versus the amount requested by applicants per grant line. For cultural heritage grants, you can see the total requested amount far exceeds the amount allocated. For capacity building grants, the request was 10 times more than what was allocated. For civics grants, the request was nearly 6 times more than what was allocated. And for our emergency response and festival grants, the requests were nearly 5 times more than what was allocated. This slide shares the average funding request for each grant line. In this current biennium period, the legislation provided that at least 25% of the cultural heritage grant dollars went to grant applicants requesting $150,000 or more. If you go back to the previous slide, you will see if the legislature requested that all the cultural heritage funding go to applicants requesting $150,000 or more, MHC would have met that request. As such, if the legislature requested that all the cultural heritage funding go to applicants $75,000 or less, MHC could have also met this request. The highlight here really is that there's great demand for larger and smaller size projects within the state. I thought it would be nice to provide a map of grants funded throughout Minnesota cities and communities. At MHC, we know that about 70% of Minnesota population resides in 7 counties, and we bring great intentionality in making our final determinations that we have grants going out to the other 80 counties that is proportionate to the 30% of the population outside the 7 counties. Grantees support and assistance. One of the things that MHC grants team implemented in the fall of 2024 was sharing best practices through a grantee newsletter. This newsletter provides tips and answers questions to grantees throughout their grant agreement, and it's been received really, really well by our current grantees. The grants team also provides new grantee orientation sessions for each new grant line. The orientation sessions discuss MHC expectations, grant agreement expectations, including reporting needs, and also sharing legacy requirements. We really look at this as our recipe for success, providing clarity at the beginning of each of our grant opportunities, sprinkling best practices throughout the grant term through our grantee newsletter. Our team also does monthly check-ins with grantees. And then also interim report check-ins and being available to answer questions and respond promptly. This committee enjoyed this slide during last year's presentation, so I've updated it for you today. This really provides you with a snapshot of the communities served throughout the state. with legacy funding. In closing, and before I turn it over to our amazing CEO, Kevin Lindsay, they're really the message, the highlight here is that there's an unprecedented demand. The interest in grants is at an all-time high across all funding categories. And the exciting new opportunities or recently funded grant lines during this biennium have been met with an overwhelming enthusiasm by applicants. There really is a lasting impact. Legacy funding continues to be a vital resource for communities across Minnesota. The grants team at MHC has the privilege of working with grantees and witnessing these amazing projects come to fruition every day. I would like to thank you for the work that you do to support Legacy in Minnesota. Your continued support for legacy funding truly brings so much joy to Minnesota communities, children, and families. Mr. Chair and representatives, I'd like to turn it over to our CEO, Kevin Lindsay, who will provide an update on our program side.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Appreciating the time, I will go through the slides. Feel free to follow up with any questions after today's hearing. We'd be more than happy to supply that information. Our legacy request is for $2.5 million in 26 and 27. We believe the great demand of grantees to support those grantees additionally, the programming that we've seen all around the state, there is an interest for more legacy programming. I appreciate the comment made earlier during the State Arts Board presentation about the importance for folks to see art in their respective community and how important that is. If we go to the next slide. Indigenous programming, this is the fourth year that we have done the Dakota Ojibwe Language Symposium. Appreciate the work of this legislature in identifying the importance of language preservation. We take that work very seriously in partnership with the Indian Affairs Council. The Native American Live Series is where we've now expanded the number of books within that series from 3 to 12 to support early language for K through 5 students. The Shakopee and Washington Sioux have expanded their respective museum, Hochikacha T, and we are in partnership with Learning from Place Opportunities with them. If we go to veterans program, we had an opportunity to bring two of our veterans, Scott Glue, who is a social studies teacher in Sauk Rapids, and then also Jesse Atherton, who leads our efforts in and around the state capitol. These two veterans are emblematic, I think, of our work within veterans and reaching into that respective community. We also appreciate the objects of storytelling, objects of war, individual veterans being able to bring various objects of significance and meaning to them, their loved ones also understanding the significance of these respective objects, very powerful storytelling within that space. If we go to lifelong learning, there is work that we do within the schools to support their work, but as you know, all of us are lifelong learners for the entirety of our life. The learning from place and providing opportunities for people to say, hey, I have driven by this place many times, I did not know its history, is very powerful, and people are appreciating the programming that we're putting together within that space. If we go to civic engagement, we just got back from St. Cloud for the social studies conference there. We presented on a couple of the particular materials we had prepared and created over the last 2 years. We host at our event center opportunities for educators to come to our respective location. The history for the Minnesota Humanities Center, if you go back into 1991, a study by this legislature, it specifically directed us to work more intentionally with school districts. We take that work to heart, and we listen to the stories and the efforts of those local educators to deliver the quality instruction they want to at their local level. If we go to the last slide here, convening connection, I think we'll bring it here within that 11:45 for you, Mr. Chair. Latino poetry, places we call home. This is a national effort by Library of America, and we had to compete for this project to be able to bring this to Minnesota. And this is one in which Latino teachers all around the state have really appreciated having this rich resource for them. I think that this is going to pay dividends for instruction within schools for the next decade within this space. Take to Me Where Life is an opportunity to bring an artist from Spain to talk about how caregivers can use art to create greater connection to their loved one who is suffering Alzheimer's or dementia. The artist very powerfully was able to incorporate dance and art within Duluth, and we're hoping that she's going to be able to come to the Twin Cities area and do something very similar, a 6 to 8 week period. Museum on Main Street, again, this is a Smithsonian effort in which we have traveling exhibits that travel all throughout the state of Minnesota. We are a leader among humanities councils across the nation in partnering with Smithsonian, and this is an effort in which we're making connection across the state. While it's not on the slide, let me end with this. We decided in partnership with Danger Boat Productions that it's really important for us to see the connection to create partnership with our neighbors. So what we did is we brought them to various communities, partnering with a local community organization, and we asked people four questions. What do they love about their town? What do people get wrong about their town? What would they like to see for their town? And what hope do they have for their town? On the basis of those conversations at little small tabletops of 6 to 8 people, the comedians were able to create a comedic skit out of that. And we played Emily, Minnesota. There's 10 other towns that we played, but Emily, I think, is the one where we can say we had the greatest participation per capita because we had 85 people in the town of 843 come out for the show. So creating this connection so people see their neighbors to understand how they can build together for Minnesota for its benefit, we're seeking to try to do that every day. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll stand for questions for the committee.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Lindsay. I believe you and I started our careers here at the Capitol together when you were appointed by Governor Dayton as the Commissioner of Human Rights, and I was sworn in 2011, so good to see you again. We're a little grayer now, though, unfortunately, right?
Very, very true. Very, very true, Mr. Chair.
We have time for one question. Otherwise, I appreciate you offering to have any member follow up with you both afterwards, and that is going to be by Representative Chaw. You have the only question publicly here anyway.
Well, thank you for the honor, Chair. And, you know, Director, thanks for being here. Thanks for the work that you do in all communities and the work that you continue to do. I always appreciate you being here, and this is my third time being in this committee. I see that last year the total funding was $15 million, and I don't mean to pit this against the arts funding, but arts got about $97 million compared to the $15 million that you did funding last year. You know, I guess it's an open question, and, you know, I mean, like, I see the grants that are coming in and how much more we can do as a legislation, right? And I find that the work that you do in humanities is so vital to all communities and the history and preservation of culture and diversity because it's more centric in that. And so I guess the question is, if you had more fundings, what more can you do? Thank you.
Very good. Mr. Lindsay?
Representative Cha, Chair McDonald, members of this committee. I think what Tristy said earlier about creating greater connection all throughout the state of Minnesota, I think we would find our ability to do more within creating that connection. When I have asked people what kind of program that they would like within their community, they would like projects that really facilitate honest conversation and dialogue. We like to come in a nonpartisan way to be facilitators of conversation. We sincerely believe in local communities being able to come up with solutions on their own and within that space. I think we would help out within the space of education tremendously. I think we hear all the time from teachers and educators how to help create more resources for us so we can be more powerfully effective within the classroom. One area that I'm really interested in is K-5, because with the ELA reading initiative here at the legislature and what we're hearing from teachers is that they need more enriched materials to ensure our youngest scholars are off to the best state. This body knows is that one of the most powerful, successful things that any society can do is equip its earliest learners with skills to succeed. And in that space, I think we could be tremendously helpful. So thank you for the question. And I'll say just really briefly, this is Tristy's first time ever testifying today at the legislature. So I just really appreciate the warm welcome you showed her.
Very good. Thank you. Ms. Auger, you did a fantastic job, as did, of course, Mr. Lindsay. Thank you both so much. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Next, we have our Minnesota Citizens for Arts presentation, one of my favorite Joes here at the Capitol, just because he has a good name and he's a good guy, Mr. Joe Bagnoli.
Get ready for a lot of questions, Joe.
Yeah, we're going to go, Joe, or Mr. Bagnoli said he'd be done about 8 minutes, ten minutes. And that'll give us 2-3 minutes to run up to the Capitol, or to the session floor.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Joe Bagnoli. I am a lawyer and lobbyist with Winthrop & Weinstein Law Firm, and I represent the Minnesota Citizens for the Arts. Minnesota Citizens for the Arts is a 600-member association, nonprofit association of artists, organizations from every corner of the state. We are proud to basically represent the arts here at the state capitol and throughout the state, I'd say sort of beat the drum, cheerlead, and do the work to try to connect people, as Director Jens talked about, to the arts in their communities. I'm here to talk to you today about two little sheets that are in your packet that have been recently done that are important that don't get talked about. I wouldn't say don't get talked about enough, but the most important thing to talk about with the arts is always the art and the connections and the vitality that it brings to communities and the importance to communities, which Director Jens talked about. But recently, the Americans for the Arts conducted a study, which is a national association, conducted basically a return on investment or an economic impact study of what the arts means. Frankly, they did it through a number of the states, 50 states, and did it in Minnesota as well. And they determined, and this is excluding sort of what the state provides, but what's the economic impact of the state? They determined that it's a $1.6 billion impact to the state, annual economic impact. It's the total financial effect of arts and cultural spending, including the ripple effect of audiences spending on local businesses like restaurants, hotels, and retails. It's spending that supports jobs, strengthens local businesses, and contributes to tax revenue. To put it in perspective, Minnesota's creative sector contributes 3.08% of the state's GDP. That's almost as large, and I've got a little sheet that I've got sectors and show where we are. It's almost as large as transportation and construction sectors that are traditional economic powerhouses, and frankly, slightly larger than ag, forestry, and utilities, which most people understand as important. I'm not trying to draw a comparison. Every one of these industries is important and contributes to the livelihood and GDP of Minnesota. But mostly it's just to give a sense of where arts actually fit in Minnesota from an economic perspective. Arts are a tourism driver. They, throughout the state, I know in Representative Scraba's district, what's going on in Grand Marais, for instance, in terms of the tourism that gets drawn there for the arts community in Grand Marais. In Representative Olson's district, the Opera House and the kind of community that gets brought in there, and certainly in some of the metropolitan areas, Representative Hussein's district, there's a wonderful dance right on the Green Line, right on University Avenue, a wonderful dance organization there that is small but really serves an interesting group of people and creates to the vibrant space. So in any case, tourism everywhere, a lot of jobs directly in the arts, people working in the arts. And then a lot of the multiplying effect of the when people go to art, generally people go out to eat and go to an art opening or an art thing. It's not just, and then for the individual artist, that's, I was talking a little bit about the organization, but for the individual artist to give them a leg to stand on and ability to do their art is really, really important, really unique to Minnesota. It's one of the things, in addition to the lakes, streams, fish, habitat that we have in Minnesota, that makes this a great place to live. While arts and culture contributes to the Minnesota's economy, their impact is especially critical in greater Minnesota, where arts organizations often serve as economic anchors. I'll just point to Winona as another place that's somewhat like Grand Marais, which a new representative, Rapinski, I believe his name is, represents. There's a Shakespeare Festival there every summer. They have a great art museum, one of the best marine art museums in the world. It's just kind of amazing, and people travel to and go there. So there are places around the state that make that the arts are important to. So I just wanted to bring that to you. I have that's my short and sweet. We've got a couple of handouts that show what we're measuring, just to give you a sense of from the economics point of view where we're at. We, as many of you know, because we've met with many of you over the last couple of weeks, strongly encourage you to continue your commitment to the arts. We've in statute, there's a 47%. It's the arts and cultural or historic. David Kelleher would hit me because I don't quite get the historic cultural portion of this. Thank you. There we go. But it's the arts and cultural, and there's a 47% commitment to that that we encourage you to look at. The only final thing I would say is just a matter of observation that from this year, looking at what's happened to this sum of money, there has been an increasing, because the bonding bill has a very, very low target. I don't know who's all in the Capital Investment Committee here, but it's lower than it's ever been. That has caused a number of people to introduce, to look for money in other places. God forbid politics happens in this place. And it's one of the old, and so I would just caution you as you put together your bill that if this becomes a bonding bill, a secondary bonding bill, that will have ripple effects. Precedent that you set now will have, could have ripple effects down in the future. So I would just, with that, I wanted to just give you a sense of the economic impact to arts, not just in the metro area, but around the state, and give you that little caution, and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bignolia. Yes, you and I spoke about that. We see a lot of bills coming in the Senate that deal with infrastructure and here too. We'll give everyone an opportunity to present, but we need to be mindful of what this appropriation of money is really for, but duly noted. If there's no further business for this committee, we are adjourned until next Wednesday at 10:15.